Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Race and Lanes with your hosts Rico Muhammad and Chuck Snow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Race and Lanes podcast. Happy New Year. We made it, 2021. Congratulations to everyone. Tonight, we have a pretty special show lined up for you guys this evening. We're going to have on special guests Hank Seaton and Tommy Root. So we're going to start the year off with the bang. We're going to let them, you know, we're going to get the first bout of the year in early and get the fireworks started. But we are going to start the show off, as we normally always do, with this week's DAT Trend Lines report for the previous week, if I can get my technology to work with me here. And so we have showing the diesel prices for this week have slowly creeped up just a little bit by 0.8 percentage point to showing a national average of $2.64 per gallon on average. And we are showing that shippers look to move freight before the closing of the books on 2020, but the shortened holiday week made truckload capacity more difficult to source. Higher load-to-truck ratios for each segment led to higher rates to end the year. So we're going to take a look and see how the things perform as the year closed out and across each segment type, starting off with the dry van rates. And we're going to be starting out in the northeastern portion of the United States. We're showing the national average outbound spot market rate out of the Northeast at 214. Moving down to the mid-Atlantic and southeastern states, we are showing a national average outbound spot market for dry vans at 264. Coming out of the Midwest, we're showing a national average outbound spot market rate of 271. Coming out of the South Central region, we're showing a national average of $2.26 per mile. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an average outbound spot market rate of 262. Switching gears and jumping over to the flatbed or the skateboard portion of the report, we are showing that coming out of the Northeast, we're showing a national average of $2.31 per mile for flatbeds. Coming out of the Mid-Atlantic and Southeastern states, we're showing a national spot market rate, outbound rate of 258. Moving out of the Midwest, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 281. Dropping down to the South Central region, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 231. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 222. Rounding out, we're going to be looking at the temperature control, the reefer portion of the report. We're showing an outbound spot market rate coming out of the Northeast at 230. Moving down to the Mid-Atlantic and Southeastern states, we're showing an outbound spot market rate for reefers at 233. Jumping back up into the Midwest, we're showing an outbound rate of 306 per mile. Moving out of the South Central region, we're showing an outbound spot market rate of 260. And coming out of the West Coast, we're showing a national outbound spot market rate of 278. And with that being said, let me welcome in my co-host, Mr. Chuck Snow. Chuck, good evening. How are you?
I'm well, Rico. How you doing, man? Happy New Year to you and your family.
Happy New Year to you and yours, Chuck. Doing well. Had a pretty good New Year. Got a chance to see a few family members over the New Year holiday and everything, and got to bring it in back in my hometown. But how did you and yours celebrate?
You know what? Very quiet dinner. Had an incredible dinner, raw oysters, ate pasta for the first time in about 3 years. My son made a rigatoni dish that was off the charts, and short ribs. And, of course, we We did have some red wine, and at 12 midnight when Anderson Cooper and his buddy Andrew Cohn were dropping the big ball, we had a glass of champagne just to make sure that 2020 came to an end and the new year came in. We stayed up for that. Shortly after that, we retired. It had been a long day.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, I'll tell you what.
But I did want
to like Michael
at
Buffer.
The end of 2020.
Yeah, I'm glad to see it go. But tonight, you know, I kind of feel like Michael Buffer, you know, getting ready to announce the big heavyweight fight. You know, I don't think I can say it. I think he has that thing patented. I think he has it patented where you can't necessarily say his little catchphrase. But you know, it's the, we definitely we're in for. It's really a treat. You know, we jokingly say, you know, talk about the guys going back and forth, but we're really in for a treat because we're so blessed and fortunate to have two industry experts that are top people in their field that are so well-knowledged and so well-versed. And of course, we, you know, it's good to have a little bit of discourse so because that's the way that we learn, and it's good to have differing views of opinions. That's definitely a great way to you know, to have a free-thinking, spirited back-and-forth debate, and we pick up a lot of insight with that. And so I don't want to belabor the point. I want to go ahead and welcome our guys on. Good evening, Hank. How are you?
I'm doing well, Rico.
Glad to have you join us. I'm going to bring Tommy on in just a second. I'm going to give you guys each a little bit of an introduction because I want to maybe spend a few minutes with you, Hank, just, and then we're going to do the same for Tommy when we bring him on. But it's the new year. We got potentially new administration coming in. What are some new things that may be coming down the pipe from D.C.? Because we know you definitely keep your ear to the pulse of what's going on nationally and things of that nature when it comes to regulations. So are there anything coming down new that we may need to be aware of before we get into the proceedings this evening?
Well, the Debbie Downer of the year may very well be created between now and the inauguration. And the Debbie Downer is the thing that I really think hits most of your listeners right between the eyes. I think I mentioned before that the current Department of Labor was trying to rush through a new rule, which would have made it a whole lot easier across industries to define an independent contractor for tax purposes. Unfortunately, our administration in its last few months has looked like the gang that can't shoot straight, and I think that has happened again. We tried to get to the Department of Labor and suggest, look, with respect to independent contractors in the trucking industry, it's a matter of federal case law and the truth in leasing regulations. We really shouldn't be subject to any stinking DOL interpretation that could be changed as often as your undershorts change based upon a change of the administration. Well, the DOL did not heed our request that if they were going to publish anything, they said, look, the independent contractor model in trucking is a court-approved carve-out and is not subject to our proposed new rule. So they're coming down with a new rule, and if anybody has read the press about the new rule, the pundits say it's dead on arrival because the new administration will just put the rule on freeze and overturn it. The fear is that they've established in the DOL that's going out the principle that silly DOL can change the rules and upend the independent contractor status with an opinion of a bureaucrat. And that's really particularly frightening, regardless of how the election in Georgia turns out tonight, because we know that at the top of the Biden agenda is to reclassify most independent businessmen as employees so that they can get the good union jobs they think they deserve and they can be fully taxed. So I think that the way things are shaping up, in one way or another, you're apt to see the ABC test or the AB5 standard be inserted in trucking at the federal level, which will leave owner-operators who've made investments in trucks based upon the entrepreneurial zeal that built America having real problems. I think as we've talked, and I'm sure you agree, Rita, there is a micro step to go from being an independent contractor to being a two-truck Charlie and having to shag loads and buy insurance and all of that. And, you know, that's a barrier that independent contractors have been able to choose. It's going to be tough, really tough, I think, for us to figure out what now do we do with the independent contractor model given the change of this administration. So that's my major concern, and I think that the listeners, the 800,000 independent contractors who don't view it as sweatshop on wheels but view it as an entrepreneurial right are going to have to be heard to at least convince some business-minded Democrats that the progressive agenda shouldn't kill the model. So there are a lot of things to worry about, but that's what worries me the most in the coming year.
All right. Well, definitely, Hank, we definitely appreciate it. And with that being said, and without any further ado, we want to go ahead and welcome our other expert and guest on board with us, Mr. Tommy Root. Good evening, Tommy. How are you?
Rico, I am fine, and Chuck, I'm fine, and Hank, I'm glad to see you're in good voice tonight.
I'm well, sitting in the eighth of a hospital.
Well, Tommy, we want to pose the same thing to you that we just posed to Hank. With the new year, you know, closing out 2020, coming into 2021. What are some different changes and there things that we may need to be aware of or be conscious of that's coming in as far as insurance and things that, of that nature that we might need to be, you know, that we might definitely want to keep our eyes on and be aware of with the flipping and the changing of the calendar?
Rico and Chuck and Hank, I want to talk just very briefly, Hank. Brought up independent contractors, I totally agree with you. They're the backbone of the industry, and anything that would impair that is a problem for not only insurance company but for the economy and the whole national economy. So I'm concerned about that. But from an insurance standpoint, the problem is this labor standard set at the federal level does not address the definition of employee at the state work comp level. And even though what they do up there, there's still going to be the question, are they independent contractor or not under the state work comp laws? So just because the federal government comes up with a standard, clearly we would argue that and try to piggyback that, but you'll still be an employee in North Carolina, period, if you're an owner-operator working for a motor carrier, because that's North Carolina. I'm dealing with a case up in New England where they're even making a broker employee of the truck companies that the trucking companies that they brokered loads to, and are trying to charge a premium of a third of everything they paid that independent contractor broker of the broker load, a legitimate broker with no transportation authority. So from an insurance standpoint, I'd like everything Hank said, and I have some of the same observations, that part of it, although it's not dissimilar to Obama also proposed a lot of those things, and there was a lot of smoke, but they never got through with those things. That's from an insurance standpoint. I just don't want anybody to have an illusion, even if Hank is successful, and I hope he is in this effort, and his people, it's not going to affect the work comp, which is the insurance part of it, and that's the exposure there. The couple things that I am concerned about, And again, good or bad, I don't want to. I believe that this issue of increasing the limits from the 750 to a number that might be reasonable, hopefully not the 4 million, a million or a million and a half is going to be on the table again. Again, that came out of the Obama administration with the act that they passed for and studied it on the MAP 21, and it went up, and that their FMCSA and DOT did not even find enough evidence to justify a raise over the 750,000, and nothing has been sitting there. But I think that's going to raise itself again. We're still worried about the younger drivers, the Smart Act, and this kind of stuff. A lot of the trucking industry is in favor of having some kind of introduction level for 18-year-olds to drive 18-wheelers, which is a little dangerous from an insurance standpoint. So we're worried about those kind of things. The biggest thing that we're hopefully coming out of 2020 is that the public will have a more favorable opinion of truckers, to realize that they're essential, that they're thanking the trucker for getting their toilet paper and their mask and the vaccines, particularly now, to the locations that need to be so people can take advantage of it. And we hope that sometimes now when we go to court and the plaintiff's attorneys try to make the trucker out as a big bad enemy, that our defense attorneys and others will be in a position to argue, yes, they're essential, they're good people, they're here to help you, and they're just somebody trying to make a living, as Hank said, the entrepreneur trying to make a living. And as long as they're conforming to the rules and regs, maybe we get some more favorable court rulings.
In response to what Tommy said, I don't want the people listening in to think that Rico and Chuck have organized another chicken fight tonight, because Tommy and I obviously agree on most things. Two comments. The workman's comp issue, Tommy is right, is one could say that we ought to have preemptive legislation, and you shouldn't balkanize the states by being classified as subject to workman's comp in North Carolina, but not South Carolina. But that's nothing that I think we could deal with. Unfortunately, that's here, and if you choose to live in North Carolina rather than South Carolina, you're going to contribute to the take. We can't solve all the things, but there are other issues in terms of establishing a national standard. Let me run this by you. The Fair Labor Standard Act currently has a carve-out from overtime for truck drivers because they're subject to hours of service requirements. So that means that, you know, a truck driver under federal standards can be paid for straight time for 70 hours for the week he's away from home. If the feds start messing with that at the federal level, there's talk of saying that a truck driver who's away from home is not subject to the 70-hour rule for overtime purposes. He would be basically on duty for over 110 hours a week. And if he got overtime at $15 an hour, a small carrier would have to pay his driver something like $100,000 a year, just on the recalculation of overtime. And $15 an hour becomes part of the new agenda. You can say from the point of view of the driver, well, hot damn, I'll now be paid for my just work. But I think we all understand the repercussions of that kind of minimum wage and that kind of classification through the industry. I think the first thing you'd see is a ramp up of platooning, cutting back on truck drivers. I think it would become a 9-to-5 job, and the guy who currently owns his own truck, and it's one truck and one driver, would be a financially unreasonable alternative to shift work. So I'm just saying there are real repercussions of all of this that could cripple the backbone of the industry, as Tommy's acknowledged, and also you'd really have to be aware of the shakeout.
I mean, it would kill the economy as well, because our economy Our economy is not built to pay every truck driver $100,000. It's just the numbers aren't there.
No, and particularly the independent contractor model pays based on productivity. You pay a guy to stand on a shovel or pay him to sleep in a sleeper berth, you have just taken the value of entrepreneurship out of it.
Totally.
I totally agree, Chuck. That's the concern, is the economy and shutting it down and changing the model. And even to the point, if you want to talk about the insurance problem, is now, as you well know, and you and I have talked about this, 85 to 90% of people with MC numbers have less than 5 power units. That's where most members of the foundation, and those are the risks that are typically written in the insurance industry, first dollar that are the bread and butter. Also, the insurance industry riding truckers. The larger motor carriers come up with some kind of sophisticated financing and things like that, and very few agents and companies function that. So that's how it would hurt the insurance industry, is there'd be less opportunity to write more policies as far as because we have forced people out of business. The one thing that I don't think the public understands in all this, eventually, no matter what happens, the $100, $100,000 a year, independent contract, whatever happens, the property will be moved. It might be moved by larger motor carriers. It might be moved by unions. It might be moved by some hybrid. But if that increase is there, the public's going to end up paying for it with what they buy consumer goods. And that's the thing they don't understand. Even with these large judgments, they don't understand eventually who pays for it all. It's not the motor carrier, not the insurance industry, but them when they buy a good, where that good now has a cost to move it from A and B that's been increased because of these kind of comments. And that's a message we need to get out too, Hank, I believe, is that this is an inflationary process as well as the other problems that we bought out that is going to affect the economy. That's where I am concerned about it.
Well, Tommy, in our coalition that made the comments in the DOL, we reached out to a major shipper group who joined in, pointing out that the independent contractor model was the backbone of long-haul trucking, and that it would disrupt not only shipper patterns but shipper costs. And you know, we have this hostility between groups, this hostility between political parties. That means that by and large, we can't work together. The TIA doesn't work very well with OIDA. OIDA doesn't work very well with ATA. And you've got a very disruptive situation in Washington in which the politicians, who can only listen to an elevator speech because their attention's only about 5 minutes long, gets mixed signals. If we're going to get anywhere, if we're going to have to get anywhere, the large carriers are going to have to realize that the idea of leveling the playing field by increasing the amount of the minimum insurance is self-destructive, because every one of those large carriers is looking at pivoting to a power-only model, and they're in turn going to have to use two-truck Charlie, who isn't going to be able to go out and get $2 or $3 million worth of insurance. He's already hamstrung by the marketplace and already, in many instances, paying $10,000 more per unit for his truck than the pricing available to large carriers. So that insurance discrepancy just gets exacerbated if you raise the amount. And, I'm in the process of doing a presentation on how unfair these crammed down shipper and broker contracts are in the spot market. They are simply not fit for anybody to sign. But when presented to a small man stuck in Keokuk as take it or leave it, you can't change a word, he gets desperate, and when he's uninformed about what he signed, then he's waiting for to be put out of business because he signed an improvident contract. And I know Tommy understands this. The insurance companies understand the pitfalls of accepting limits beyond CarMac, and they know there's not insurance for it. It's just Two Truck Charlie doesn't understand what he's signing. He's the only member in the. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say how many don't even know what CarMac means, Chuck. But I mean, Hank,
exactly.
Much less how to structure their tariffs and all to build those things in. Hopefully, they got an agent who explains that to them, because I've explained it to agents, and even they need to know that. But I totally agree with you.
Let me make that simple for anybody that's listening. There are general principles of federal transportation law. There is a federal statute, which is a compromise that's been around for 100 years, and the best you can hope for is to get insurance that's roughly comparable to the statute. But to get that coverage, your insurer has to be able to examine the salvage. There has to be mitigation. There has to be inspection. There's this wonderful provision in the law that says that the shipper doesn't get special or consequential damages. All of those terms are written out of the majority of the spot market contracts that are presented to you guys through MRIS, and you're told to sign it or you don't get the load. So that means that as a matter of risk assessment, you're skating naked.
Just to make a note and make sure, since we're talking, so we don't have apple and orange. What Chuck says is absolutely true, but it has to do with cargo, not the $1 million limit for their liability,
right,
connected to their filings. Just make sure that we're not talking about the same thing when we talk about increase the limits. That's for liability. That's for the BI and PD,
yes,
involved in the truck crash to pay for damaged people. CarMac addresses the liability of a motor carrier and the responsibility of a shipper, as it has to do with interstate cargo claims.
Absolutely. Good point. With respect to this increase in liability, there is an endorsement that the insurance company has to sign off on that says that ultimately if the carrier is liable, they will pay up to that amount. That doesn't mean that the insurance company can't take the position that the vehicle wasn't insured and turn around to the carrier and ask for the premium back. But it's a completely different regime in terms of risk assessment than the cargo liability. The cargo issue comes back to bite you in the rear when there's an offset for a cargo claim against freight charges, or when you don't know what you're hauling and you find out that it was a missile, not a used machine. It's hard as hell, to, as we talked about before, for a carrier to or a broker to get beyond this thing called an accord and really find out what the exclusions are in the policy. But you're certainly not going to get a policy that says we will indemnify the shipper if something happens in the discussion.
Good point.
You know, when we think about the new regime, and I think Hank brings up a very valid point, is our industry is so fragmented as far as different interests. If you look at who are members of these different entities, the truckload carriers or the American Trucking Association or IATA or the brokerage associations, they all have different interests. They don't realize their interests are really the same. And they're things that are generally good for everybody, that they seem to not push those things together and want to get on the agenda. Hank, I don't know what you – I guess you've already expressed yourself that way. Chuck, I don't know. You've had a deal – you know, if this independent contractor comes up, you and I have talked about coming with some cooperative. A lot of insurance companies or agents have also set up something called a settlement model where the trucker gets their own authority, and then – the trucking company becomes an asset-only brokerage situation as long as the customers will accept that kind of stuff. So there's going to be work around that. My concern is not the insurance part of it, as y'all point about the economy, the economics of it, and driving the smaller motor carrier. I mean, there's so many things that are driving the smaller motor carrier out of business. I've been saying this forever, but that's a part of it. The increased limits are part of it. The idea of having electric trucks as a part of it. The equipment that's now needs to be bought and have and put on a truck to even get insurance anymore is a part of it. Those are the things that are concerned I'm with because, you know, as you know, my father started with one truck, and it'd be hard today to start with one truck.
Well, people do, though. You know, people are able to start with one truck and build if they have a good business plan. My biggest concern for anybody wanting to get into it, you know, your dad started with one truck. I started with one truck. We could buy Rico started with one truck. Hank, you have a relative that's in this business. They probably started with one truck. You know, the problem with starting with one truck today is getting the insurance for the one truck. It's become, especially if you're a new entity, that concerns me to no end. And even if you've got five or six trucks, you're still not big enough to be recognized as a fleet. And
well,
you're at the mercy of the insurance company.
We've talked about this, and you know, I don't want my friend Tommy to get defensive about it, but when you look at the way insurance is sold, obviously it's cheaper by the dozen. Obviously, an insurance company is more concerned about writing a 100 truck fleet that's got pretty good averages than it is to take a risk on a newbie. But beyond those things, you can't. Insurance company is going to make its own decisions. But just when you look at the expenditure involved, it's hard to say that one truck Charlie is going to have an even chance when his insurance is only sold by two or three people, both who have records of writing it and quickly canceling it. And the premiums are three or four times what the larger fleets are getting. I read you know, some of the stuff that comes across the internet from new people getting started griping about insurance rates, and I've tried to check that out with you know, my guys who have 10 or 15 trucks, and the differential in the price on the $1 million worth of insurance is astounding. You know, you're talking about the difference between maybe $6,000 and some looking at 21. You know, that's real money when you say, look, I'm going to start my own operation, and, you know, I'm not going to give up any stinking percentage to a carrier, and I'll be my own man, but I'm starting with an extra $1,000 a month cost.
At least.
Built into the system. That's crazy.
You know what? It's probably about two or three years ago I was talking to our guest, Tommy, and at that time, he was telling me that a new carrier he knew, you know, it was either Dade or Broward County down in South Florida, a brand new carrier, they were paying $25,000 for insurance. You know, it was a one truck carrier, brand new carrier. And,
power,
you know,
unit.
It's gone up from there. What's that, Tom?
Yeah. Per power unit.
per unit. Yeah.
Per power unit.
Yeah.
I
don't want to defend. I'm defending the insurance industry, and this lets you know that the results of writing a new venture, someone with less than 2 years' experience and no history, is far more of a problem than and has lost money, and the insurance company has lost money doing it. This is basically why they moved away from that. And if I had to come up with one plan on this part, and this is kind of a circular answer, that's why it won't float, is that part of it is because they don't have a business plan. They don't have enough cash to go through the system, and the insurance industries have the insurance provider cancels it and then tries to collect the payment on it, and then they have, then they push the envelope and don't do maintenance. You know, everything that when you have a strapped insurance business, these things just exacerbate each other. I'm not saying that the insurance industry isn't a part of it, but having the outrageous price too. But Hank is right. There's only one or two, our friends in Cleveland and our friends in Omaha, they're even willing to look at new ventures.
Yep. And they'll
The other thing that, you know, I'd like to find a solution to it in this day of premiums, risk, and all of that. And most of the little trade associations I represent, when a guy gets to a certain size, he joins a captive or he raises his SIR or he plays around with the coverage to get those premiums down. You know, it would be wonderful if there were some kind of way to get into the market and form a risk retention group. OIDA's tried it. Heck, they don't get anywhere with it. But what I'm saying is that would basically say, okay, we're going to take these owner operators that are becoming carriers, and we're going to give them the kind of safety shakedown and safety training that they would get from a Great West. We're going to monitor these folks. We're going to put them through the drill so that that we know they understand and abide by the records. And then we're going to, in some sense, set up maybe a combination of LOCs or whatever else you can put together to entice someone to write these folks as groups. I think the first time that you'll see that is when people like Convoy or maybe some of the large carriers that are going to the power only move realize that the two truck Charlie is their logistic partner, and that they need to keep them in business, and somehow without buying the wreck, help facilitate reasonably priced insurance. So that, you know, they can be that outlet for the extra freight. And I don't know how to do that. Tommy knows that, you know, there's some folks in Cleveland, I think, that are actively out here working with niche carriers and trying to extend this program to classes of carriers regardless of size. You know, if somehow we could get some moxie together to make that work, it's certainly a problem that's worth working on. I don't have any answers, but I do think that all of that zeal of the circle of friends to raise the insurance minimums to $5 million to level the playing field against the little guys has lost a lot of their steam now that they're looking at needing to work with those guys.
Right. Well, you know what? We've talked about this before, and I'll mention it again. I think there's room out there for a cooperative that comes to the market with insurance for new carriers that have to have. You can't just take somebody that's never driven a truck before, but basically the Landstar type model. I think Landstar is a great company. I have nothing but admiration for them and respect, but they do a great job out there. I know people have trucks on with Landstar, and they're safety-wise, they're pretty strict with their owner-operators. And I think that this can be done successfully and offer these people insurance. I think if we – go ahead, Tom.
Let me give you an insight on this, and if our audience listening, I hope they listen carefully to this. We've had a few people coming aboard who are willing to offer insurance – with some programs. They're not captive. I don't like a risk retrenching group because there's no guarantee fund, and two or three of those went down. It depends on how they're managing, and even captives are hard to get out of. because of the cash flow, and most motor carriers can't afford those kind of things. So, you know, I say if you go in a captive, you got to have a prenuptial going in, or you're going to get burned. But what the insurance companies are looking at now is, will you share your EDL data with us? And if you'll let us, if you'll share the EDL data, equip your truck with event recorders, cameras, and those kind of things, and we'll base our premium on your road activities as reflected in the ELD data. Now, some say, oh, that's evading privacy. That might be evading privacy, but that's what it's going to take, even for new ventures now, to get something close to reasonable insurance, is their willingness to come up and share that data so that the insurance company 100%. Is comfortable that where they're going, how they're operating the truck, and then make sure that driver is operating within the regs and rules. I mean, CSA is 100%. A problem. The reason CSA is a problem is because it's killing us in court. It's being presented. Even when Hank bills in law and says this information is not to be used in court, I'm paraphrasing what he did, it hasn't kept it out of court. So those are the kind of things they got to understand. And a lot of Hank calls the two-putt Charlie. I would call them the cowboys of the highway. And by the way, Hank, it could be females too, drivers. You said males only, but I like the
cowgirls.
Our keynote speaker was Ellen Warrior with a woman in Truckee. So I want to go through that part, even though it only represents about 10% of the driver force. But they are by far better drivers from an insurance standpoint, if you want to look at that. If I had to choose the market to come into, it would be them that I would want to start with and have that requirement that you have to be a female driver to also hedge the
bad
in that setup. But
you know, I don't disagree.
We can build on the
data.
Excuse me, Hank. Let me say, we can build on the data now and use that to have a better measurement of our motor carrier's activities and get more interest with insurance company to take care of the risk who are trying to do it right.
100%. I want to add something to that. I would go with technology. With technology, we have the availability now to charge according to where you're traveling. Somebody that's running from South Dakota to Wyoming, their insurance should be nowhere near what somebody's going from New York to New Jersey or Brooklyn to Long Island or any of those areas that are congested. So I think as an insurance provider, I think you're well within your rights to charge more for taking more risk. And when you put trucks into an area that is prone to higher risks, higher crashes, everything else, I think they should charge more where they
Chuck, looking at where people run has been something that insurance companies have put into the mix for years. My pushback on pricing it based upon technology is the broken thermometer approach that the CSA is, and the fact that so many people in the insurance industry use CSA scores as a whipping boy for a small carrier.
Right.
When you have a safety matrix that's based upon accidents per million mile, when one truck Charlene has an accident, she is 40 times the national average in terms of accident per million miles. Now, that doesn't mean that one truck Charlene was even responsible for the accident or that it's ever going to reoccur. But because of the law of small numbers, she looks terrible. And that is one of the things that, Tommy and I realize is a real problem. And that is there is an outfit called CAB, Central Analysis Bureau, which is kind of like SaferWatch and a bunch of other folks. They sell this data as a screening tool to determine bad actors. And when you get through with all of this data and stuff, you can't connect the dots between the performance of a small carrier and his future performance because he's small. Just very simply because of the number of instances. It's, you know, I tell people I don't gamble, but I know if I go put all of it on black 14, I'm going to lose.
Hey, you're not looking at it right. Get your legal, get those lawyers who you're a part of to come up and not use that CSA data in the court to reptile theory to inflame the jury to take the focus off what that driver did today and trying to say
that's
what's happened today. That's why the insurance industry, two things, Hank, and I'll give you time. You've had most of the time here. I've been quiet. Two things. The insurance industry is reacting to what they have to pay out in court. And that's the concern there. And since it's being used against us in court, we've got to keep the record as best as possible to be able to provide the defense so we don't pay for the inflation. All we pay for the damage done when we're liable. And that's the problem, as you well know, with reptile theory. The other thing is, this is going back to my other discussion. One way to overcome the CSA is because we don't have but three ways to measure the motor carrier. We can look at their past losses. New ventures don't have any. We can look at their CSA scores, or we can look at the driver's MVR. Other than that, we can't measure that. Now if we can use new data, EDL information, where they're going, those kind of things, to monitor them on an ongoing basis, then we have more opportunity to look at the overall risk and not rely on those three areas, which I agree with you are not that legitimate in a lot of ways. Now it's your turn.
Well, the one thing is, Tommy, I understand. I am not a defender of plaintiffs' bar. They will use whatever they can to goose up the verdict. They'll do whatever they can to make Charlie or Charlene look like the enemy. My concern, and you know this is true, that a lot of the defense lawyers are unwilling to go to the mat with the redaction language we have on CSA. They have done a sloppy, poor job in terms of trying to keep that material out. I have been part of one of these groups as a fact witness, and I can't motivate these people who are up to that S in state law to realize that SMS methodology, A, isn't fit for use, and B, by statute, can't be used. You know, I'm tired of getting the articles printed, making the point to my friends who are in the defense bar and seeing them not ever take somebody to the task. It's an argument that's laying there to be made. And when the SMS methodology came out, there were certain people in the insurance industry who said, hot damn, we have got a new way to separate sheep from goats. And we are now 18 years down road from the introduction of the SAFER system, and the stuff still doesn't work. And those same insurance gurus are still ginning up those scores and saying that they have to be used to credential small carriers. And, you know, I'm tired of looking at them and seeing perfectly good carriers and responsible people be pillared by these reports. I'm tired of having
Hank, if they're responsible people, why aren't they living within the regs?
It's not the regs they're violating.
Violating that has bad CSA scores?
Okay, let me give you an example. Small carrier, driver runs out of hours at a scale. Before the Tennessee scale in Giles County. He used personal conveyance to come the additional 5 miles across the scales they get him for being out of hours. Okay? We end up putting $15,000 worth of effort and going down there to fight the bus. To fight the bus that's a $150 violation. The judge down there looked at us. He told the driver when he went down there to try to defend the case, he said, "Boy, you'll get your day in court, but bring your toothbrush, because if you don't win, I'm going to lock you up." Now, you know, we're talking about local gendarme abuse. And I had to take Rick Gobble down there and look down the State Highway Patrol and tell them we were going to take them all the way up the roost. And the reason is because Two Truck Charlie's insurance company said that if that bus stayed on his record, he was going to lose his insurance. Now, the boy that owned the five trucks was going to lose his insurance because a driver who'd been with him for 20 years or a long period of time with a clean driving record got picked up by a stinking traffic violation that, given SMS methodology, was going to make him look like, in the all-important HOS, he was violating it. And you know what we ended up proving? We ended up proving that the director of the FMCSA 3 weeks before at the Louisville Truck Show had said that was a perfect use of personal conveyance. And it was all over the fact that he was going northbound rather than southbound. He was going in the direction of his home.
Chuck.
And then you add to that the reason he planned out his load. He was going to stop at a rest area in Alabama, but he got there and said it was closed. Now, you know, you put those kinds of facts together, and the system's corrupt.
Hank, that system might be corrupt, but the insurance industry has to use as a measurement, because if that person had a crash, I promise you that hours of service and the fatigue would become a part of the court case. That's where the problem is. I totally agree with you. In fact, I had a DOT officer when this first rolled out in 2010 at a program I had, and he said the one thing about it is that these are the same regs and that we've been enforcing, so we didn't train our officers about these regs. We didn't understand the consequences of these officers and what they write down like we do now. That was our mistake, so we got to retrain them to understand the importance of it. This is why the bad accused there and those things, Hank, those things need to be corrected. No, nowhere am I suggesting that CSA is good. The CSA should be at least revamped or come up with a better system. What I'm trying to tell you is, as long as the plaintiff's attorney is using that against us in court, and until we have another measurement, and I'm suggesting EDL information might be it, to understand the on-road operation of the motor carrier, it's going to be a factor. So we need to straighten out, instead of blaming the insurance industry on this, Hank, we need to straighten out that judge. We need to straighten out the enforcement officers. We need to go and arm those. Let those do that. Now, without getting it, because we only got about 6 more minutes, as you know as well as I do, if you have a bad crash and if the insurance company does not offer policy limits, when the plaintiffs ask for those policy limits, then a judgment above the policy limits are going to have to be paid in most cases, called bad faith under the insurance policy, even above the limit. This is what the pressure we're having on this, and that goes back again to these what's being introduced in court. And so that's the problem we have, and the cost to defend the case, sometimes it's easier to, you know, get out. You know lawyers as well as I do. I know you. We have a lot of friends who are defense lawyers that we have tuned into. So, you know, I understand that part of what we're going to do, but do you spend, you know, $300,000 when you can get out for $100,000? That happens too often. I wish we had a court case, and we talk about tort reform. You know, the one thing that I would do with tort reform is make it prohibitive that for all that information to be used in court in any form and fashion. That would be tort reform that I would go with.
Let me tell you this, Tommy, and I don't want to blindside you with it, but it is a federal statute. It's 49 USC, I think it's 504, and it says very clearly that any investigation conducted by the agency should not be admitted in court. It has been in the statute. We have written articles on it. A friend of mine named Foppy wrote the disseminal article on it. We used that when the FMCSA wanted to come out with this crazy idea of calling preventability. And in their decision, they said that preventability should not be used in a court of law, and they cited it. So it's not a question of needing tort reform to keep that crap out. You go find out why it is that insurance companies are not taking the FMCSA's language in its own publications and running with it. Why are they still sitting here looking at the stuff rather than using it as the first defense to keep it out? I'm tired of seeing Tom Corsi and all of these alleged experts say, oh, SMS is intended for use. It's more valid than anything else. I'm tired of seeing one of the largest law firms putting on seminars and saying, oh, well, yeah, you ought to use SMS because it's more valid than an actual safety rating. You know that's happening. The industry is undercutting itself in this. All I'm saying is we've got the legislation if people will use it.
Well, Hank, gentlemen, I'm looking at the time, and as usual.
Let me say one thing.
As usual.
Hank, you and I go to the acting meetings, and maybe you need to talk to our friends there, too, about this, because that's where it's coming from. I'm done, Rico. I'm sorry.
No. You're just fine.
Hey, Tommy, I have.
Oh, I know, Frank.
But as usual, we definitely looking at the time. We're running short on time, and and as usual with these highly spirited conversations, you guys. We run out of time, and it's so unfortunate. But in closing, would you guys like to tell? Of course, Hank, I'll give your information out. We want if you would like to get more information from Hank Seaton, transportationlaw.net. That's www.transportationlaw.net. Hank has a litany of articles and other things that are available there, and contact information is there if you would like to utilize Seaton and Huff, his firm, to help out.
Great
any
firm.
Of your legal needs or anything like that. You can check them out over there. And Tommy, tell us again how to get in contact with you and the website. You guys don't sell anything, but tell us about the information that you how to get in contact and follow you guys as well.
The information, the foundation is the Motor Carriers Insurance Education Foundation, FMCFA, Motor Carriers Insurance Education Foundation, MCIEF.org, and all you have to do to contact me is my name, Tommy@MCIF.org. And I'll answer questions. We welcome truckers, and I deal with them all the time. I deal with insurance interpretation things. Hank and I talk about in this stuff. I help the motor carrier and the insurance agents deal with this. And, again, we have nothing to sell except information to give free.
All right, Chuck, let them know how to get in contact with you, and
give me a call.
Put the first Race and Lanes podcast in the book for 2021. Go ahead, Chuck.
Okay. You can call me at 800-388-4352. My extension, 203. You need that to get hold of me. You can send me an email. Just chuck@traffix, traffix.com. If you want to get set up with Traffix or you're having some business issues or whatever it is, get hold of me. I'm glad to help any of our listeners. Or send me a private message on Instagram at Chuck Snow CEO. And with that, I want to thank our guests tonight. You guys were great as always. Certainly a spirited conversation. Can't believe how much I learned listening to both you gentlemen. I love your passion. You've both been in it for even longer than I have, and you're still both on fire. And that's why we love having you. We love having you together, because together we have like five times the fire than we normally do. It's wonderful. I really, Rico and I really appreciate it, as do our listeners.
Y'all have a good
so once again, want to thank you.
I said, I'm just hoping that we get back to some normalcy in this year.
Yeah, may we all keep it between the mustard and the mayonnaise this year.
Yes, sir.
Well, with that said, being said, Hank has already closed us out. But we want to thank you guys for being with us. You could have been anywhere else in the world, but you took a little time to hang out with us here on the Raising Lanes podcast. We're definitely eternally grateful for that. The first podcast for 2021 is in the books. God willing, we'll talk at you guys same place, same time next week. Be safe out there. Keep it in between the mustard and the mayonnaise, like Hank says. And Chuck?
Chuck's on the flip-flop.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, guys.
Thank you. Good night.
Southern Florida, you know, like I said, my wife was on the 7th.